Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, cfr.org, if you would like to share it with colleagues or classmates. We're delighted to have Elizabeth Economy with us today to talk about China's quest for natural resources. Dr. Economy is CFR's CV Star Senior Fellow and Director for Asia Studies. Her most recent book, co-authored with CFR's Michael Levy, is entitled How China's Resource Quest is Changing the World. Dr. Economy is also the author of The River Runs Black, The Environmental Challenge to China's Future, which won numerous awards. She regularly testifies before Congress and consults for U.S. government agencies. She is the Vice Chair of the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on the Future of China and serves on the board of the China-U.S. Center for Sustainable Development. She is also a contributor to the CFR blog, Asia Unbound, and you can follow her on Twitter at Liz Economy. Liz, thanks very much for being with us today. You have just written this book. It would be great if you could share with us some of the central findings of how China is changing the world.
Thanks so much, Irina. It's really a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk about the book with such a terrific group of university students and professors. If you've had the chance to read the introduction that we sent out, I think you know why Mike and I decided it was important to write this book. China's rise is really one of the great transformative processes underway in the world today, and its resource quest is at the heart of that rise. Yet we found that the impact of China's efforts to secure resources outside its border is really very poorly understood. The questions that come up are, you know, is it the savior of the global economy, or is it the scourge of good global governance? Is China undermining global security by its willingness to do business anywhere, no matter the broader sort of strategic or political context? There's a lot of hype that surrounds this issue, and Mike and I tried to go behind the headlines to get at the reality of the issue. So we look at China's resource quest across four sets of commodities: land, minerals, oil and gas, and water, and across all the continents. Look at Latin America and Africa and Southeast Asia and North America, et cetera. So I'm just going to talk about three of what Irina called sort of central findings of the book, and then I'm happy to take your questions or listen to your own thoughts on China's resource quest and its rise more broadly. So first, I think the quickest way to understand China's impact abroad through its resource quest is to look at China's behavior at home. So whether we're talking about the environment or labor issues or transparency and the rule of law, any of those sort of broader issues of governance, what we see China doing at home is very much what we see China doing abroad. So for example, we can look any day in the newspaper and see that China is facing a very severe challenge with its domestic environment. Why is that? Well, Chinese firms often don't undertake environmental impact assessments and don't implement environmental regulations on the home front. Well, we find that when they go to Zambia, they also often don't undertake environmental impact assessments or implement environmental regulations very carefully. Or we can look at the mining sector, which in China is one of the most poorly regulated, very dangerous, with very poor labor and safety practices. And then we can look at what China is doing abroad as it goes out to get access to commodities and minerals. And we can see that in Papua New Guinea and Peru, uniformly, the workers claim that Chinese mining practices are at the bottom of the barrel in terms of labor, safety, and pay. So again, what China does at home is very much what happens when China goes abroad. And finally, I'll just mention, even when you look at the issues of how China does its resource investment at home, oftentimes in backroom deals between local businesses and local businessmen and officials did simply expropriate land. We see here, too, that when they go abroad, they try to do business this way. So, for example, when I was in Brazil talking to officials there, and China has gone to Brazil to try to get access to land to grow soybeans, for example, the Brazilian officials would say, you know, the Chinese delegations often think they can come here and simply, you know, do deals with us where we'll just sign away our land. But that's not the way we do business in Brazil. We can't do business that way. And so as a result, investment in Brazil has been far less than one might have anticipated. But it's important to understand here that the story isn't over. There are a lot of pressures now on Chinese businesses to do better. So China, the Chinese government, Beijing, is putting in place a lot of regulations to deal with Chinese businesses going abroad. For example, they can't have access to loans if they don't undertake environmental impact assessments. Chinese firms themselves now often want to do better because they recognize if they're going to do business in the United States or Canada, they're going to need to up their game, or any country that has sort of stronger state capacity. Chinese NGOs, non-governmental organizations, are also bringing pressure to bear on Chinese firms, you know, traveling to Burma, Myanmar, and coming back and telling Chinese firms, you know, you need to engage local communities, you need to take their interests into account if you're going to want to do more resource investment there. And of course, it takes two to tango, so to the extent that other countries are putting in place a stronger capacity to enforce their own environment and labor and governance sort of regulations, this too helps to shape China's behavior in positive ways. So a second finding that we came up with has to do with China's impact on the global economy. And here, one of the most important takeaways is really that size matters. Certainly the numbers are striking. China commands, you know, 30 to 40% or more of the world's iron ore, coal, lead, zinc, aluminum, and copper. And it has, in fact, contributed to price rises in a host of commodities, from oil to iron ore to soybeans. But is China the resource equivalent of the Cookie Monster? Is it simply gobbling up resources everywhere it looks across the globe? I think context here matters, and it matters a lot. So China is, you know, 20% of the world population. It is the second largest economy in the world. It's been growing at upwards of 9 to 10% per year for over two decades, until really just the past 2 years. So is it unreasonable, for example, that it commands, you know, about a quarter of the world's soybean market? Or is it unreasonable that it commands about 12% of global oil output? When you put this in context of China's size, the story somewhat changes. Also, we found that China often is a second-tier investor. So you can read the newspapers and somehow come to believe that China is everywhere, right, grabbing up all these resources. But in fact, China is only the fourth largest investor in Africa. It's the third largest investor in Latin America. And it's the third largest investor even in Southeast Asia's own backyard, and quite a distant third after the European Union and Japan. And then China's third in the U.S. is a very close fourth. And when you think about, you know, read these articles about China grabbing land everywhere, well, China is the third largest overseas investor in land after Canada and the United States. So again, here, context matters. In addition, a lot of Chinese announced investment is not realized. So much of what you read in the newspapers, these enormous, you know, trade aid and investment deals. For example, since 2007, China has had announced investment in Brazil of about $70 billion. But in fact, only a third of that has been realized for a variety of reasons. So there's a lot of hype surrounding Chinese investment. And indeed, China is responsible for an enormous amount of new investment in resources. But again, it's important to look behind the headlines and get at the reality of the situation. And when you do that, you realize that this situation is not quite as striking or as significant in some ways as you might have originally thought. And finally, when we look at the global security, China has traditionally operated, you know, under a mantra of, we don't mix business with politics. And what this means in practical terms is that its firms will do business in places like Iran or Sudan or Burma, Myanmar before the political transition, you know, places where firms from many other countries are not allowed to do business because of economic sanctions. And to some extent, China's willingness to do business here can undermine the political effectiveness of these sanctions that are designed to achieve some set of broader diplomatic or security objectives. However, it's important, we found in our research, to add three caveats to this sort of general understanding of China's role in the global security. First, the international system really is an important constraining force. So, for example, in Iran, where Chinese oil and gas companies have been quite active, they haven't realized as much of their investment as they had originally anticipated. Why? Well, to some extent, in some cases, their investment would require that it import gas compressors from the European Union or the United States, and they couldn't access those because of the sanctions. In another instance, it appears that the Chinese government decided to slow down its investment in Iran because it was interested in doing business, oil and gas business in the United States. And there was a thought that the business doing business in Iran would somehow harm the potential of doing business in the U.S. And then they had difficulty finding buyers for the Iranian gas. So the international system in this sense didn't completely prevent China, certainly, from investing in oil and gas, and China has invested substantially in the oil and gas sector in Iran. Nonetheless, it has constrained, to some extent, Chinese activities there. Second, there is an emerging bottom-up pressure on Chinese government, on Chinese firms, because the people and companies are unhappy at the fact that the Chinese firms are putting Chinese citizens at risk doing business in dangerous places like Sudan. So there have been wide-ranging complaints on the Internet, for example, about placing Chinese citizens at risk. Sinohydro, which is the world's largest developer of dams and hydropower plants, has developed a list of places where it doesn't want to do business because it's too dangerous. So in this way, Chinese firms and the Chinese people are saying basically to the Chinese government, you know, we're placing a higher priority on our Chinese people, on the Chinese people, than on this idea of we don't mix business with politics. And finally, I think it's important to recognize that there are differences in the way that China manages the balance between its resource needs and its security concerns from one case to the next. So there's nothing cut and dry in that mantra of we don't mix business with politics and we'll do business anywhere at any time doesn't really always hold true. So, for example, as I'm sure many of you know, China is now involved in a number of disputes over sort of sovereignty claims in the East and South China Sea. And one of those complaints, one of those disputes is with the Philippines. Now, the Philippines is a source of important natural resources for China, especially cobalt. And there are a lot of pressures coming from Chinese firms as well as Chinese scholars on the Chinese government saying, could we please improve our foreign policy toward the Philippines because we want to be able to access these natural resources. But here is a case where the Chinese government, where Beijing has very clearly said, actually, our security interests, our claims, our sovereignty issues are much more important to us than our ability to access resources from the Philippines. Similarly, you can look back a few years when there was the fishing boat dispute with Japan in the East China Sea, and China initiated a soft embargo on rare earths. Here, too, Beijing determined that its security interests trumped its interest in selling rare earths to Japan. So it would be a mistake to assume that China's resource interests necessarily trump the broader security and diplomatic concerns of China. They don't always. So just to conclude, I hope that through my remarks I've given you some sense of the context and some of the nuance that Mike and I believe are important to get at in this issue of China's resource quest. Nothing is quite as cut and dried as many of the news reports might have us believe. And just one final thought, and that is that this is very much a dynamic process, right? The past is not prologue. China is changing, and the world is changing China. And if we look now at China's efforts, for example, to rebalance its economy, that could have profound impacts on its resource needs. So if China is able to move from investment-led growth to consumption-based growth, that will have impact on its need for iron ore. It may also have impact on its need for energy, but in not necessarily a better way, because urban residents in China use 4 times more energy than rural residents. So as China urbanizes 300 million more people, we might anticipate that it's going to have even greater demand for energy over the next few decades. These are the kinds of things that we need to keep in mind. Its security interests are clearly changing. We can see as it's pressing forth with claims in the East and South China Seas and beyond that it is beginning to assume a much larger role in its own security and in thinking about its role in global security. And finally, the Chinese people, as they demand more on the home front in terms of better governance, from corruption, anti-corruption efforts to the environment and to labor, I think we can have some hope that these efforts will then again translate into better efforts by Chinese firms abroad. So nothing in this story is static. It is changing. It is dynamic. And I think that's one of the most important takeaways from our book.
Liz, thank you very much. We appreciate your taking the time to do this. Tiffany, let's open it up to the students on the call.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. At this time, we'll open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 now. Our first question will come from Tuskegee University.
Go ahead. Yes, good morning. I'd like to tell you thank you for your presentation. It was very lovely. My first question is, why doesn't China have better labor laws if it is the third largest economy in the world?
That's a good question. I think China doesn't have better labor laws because it has had so much labor that it really hasn't had a demand from hasn't had any sort of pressure brought upon Chinese firms or the Chinese government to do things better. That's one sort of reason behind the fact that it has poor labor laws. The second, of course, is that China has not really permitted independent labor unions from forming. And so, you know, the history of China as, you know, a sort of somewhat totalitarian, transitioning to authoritarian state has meant that it has limited opportunities in many respects for independent action. And so the lack of independent labor unions and organizations to press for labor rights and better labor practices has generally been lacking not a force for improving the situation in China. I think this is changing. You know, China's demographics are changing, and labor is clearly gaining a greater hand. But this is going to be a long-term process in terms of both pushing for better enforcement of labor laws and implementation of those laws.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Texas Women's University.
Thank you, Dr. Economy, for your insightful comments. This is Michael. I was just wondering about, since you mentioned so eloquently that past is not prologue, going forward, what would your recommendation be to the new regime, hypothetically, if they were to consult you on this in China's quest for resources?
Hypothetically, of course, if they were to request my consultation. I think probably from my perspective, one of the most important things that China could do would be to really push forward on the sort of better governance practices, because one of the things that is really coming home to roost for the Chinese government is that, you know, when it does business in ways that don't resonate with, you know, local laws and regulations, and when, you know, China exports sort of worse governance practices, it doesn't have long-term good benefits for the sort of image of the Chinese regime. And so you can see that, you know, there are protests that take place in many of these resource-rich countries against Chinese firms in ways that don't occur when other firms from other countries come to do business. So, you know, in Kazakhstan, in the Philippines, in Brazil, in Argentina, for example, all those places, there have been substantial bottom-up movements to prevent Chinese firms from taking greater stakes in land. You know, in Argentina, for example, a very prominent conservation biologist stood up and said, look at what China is doing to its own land, to its own environment. Why should we allow Chinese firms to come here and have the same sort of negative impact on our land here? So I think, you know, it's important for them, for the Chinese government, to move quickly in terms of pushing forward on these better governance practices, because the long-term damage to China's reputation, and indeed I think to the Chinese ability to continue to do business, I think is pretty serious. And I'll say just one final point on this. I was recently in Burma, Myanmar, for some discussions among Chinese Burmese and Americans, as the Burmese are trying to develop sort of, you know, land rights and governance institutions, because obviously they're in the midst of a very profound political transformation. And their interest in talking to the Chinese about these issues was minimal, because they really didn't feel that the Chinese had anything to teach them. And in fact, to some extent, blamed the Chinese for some of the problems that they were facing, because China has for so long been in cahoots with the authoritarian regime and seen as a country that has simply come in and extracted a lot of the resources from Burma, Myanmar, without any sort of, you know, bringing any sort of good governance practices to the table. So I think that this sort of bad practices are coming home to roost, and I think that's an area that Chinese government needs to move quickly on to address.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from the University of Puget Sound.
Hi, Dr. Economy. Thank you for the talk. My question has to do with NGOs. Many scholars seem to think that domestic environmental degradation has given birth to civil society in terms of environmental non-government organizations, but you know, for example, Friends of Nature being able to win a lawsuit against the state, and that's pretty impressive. My question has to do with as many restrictions on where they're able to register and the limitations on their activities. Do you think that this kind of grassroots organization will effectively be able to constrain government and business practices when investing abroad?
What a great question. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how this new regime manages its relationship with civil society and with environmental NGOs. You know, certainly, as you suggest, there's been enormous growth in the environmental NGO sector over time in China. It's probably one of the most active and exciting parts of Chinese civil society today. Yet they are constrained, and there is concern that somehow the environment will turn into a broader, using the environment, sort of political activists will turn the environment into a broader push for political reform within China, so the Chinese government continues to treat them very cautiously. I don't think that the environmental NGOs in China will be able to even come close to playing the role in terms of overseas investment that they play today within China. So in other words, it's much harder for them to affect Chinese practices abroad than it is to affect Chinese practices at home. They simply don't have the bandwidth, you know, the financing, the sort of capacity in terms of the number of people engaged in sort of the environmental movement in China. It's still primarily a domestically focused movement, But having said that, you know, some NGOs such as Green Watershed, you know, have traveled to Burma, Myanmar, have done study tours to look at, you know, what is going on in terms of Chinese investment practices, and come back and said to Chinese firms, you know, you need to do a better job, for example, in terms of engaging local communities, because that is, you know, where you are, you're suffering in terms of your image and, you know, your ability to do future business. So that's an important role that the NGOs can play, but I don't see them really as shaping significantly sort of Chinese firms abroad until when and if they develop substantially more capacity for themselves.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Yale University.
Thank you, Dr. Economy. And I'd like to ask what your opinion is on the state of relationship between the state-owned enterprises, you know, the large oil and gas companies, and the Chinese leadership, because for some time it was the common conception that those state-owned enterprises were just an arm of the Chinese government and were gathering up resources for China's own use, and then there was kind of an evolved view that, well, those companies aren't necessarily under the control of the Chinese government, but as you've noted, there have been instances where the Chinese government has been able to use its power to prevent those companies from investing in certain areas. So given the Chinese government's interest in opening up its economy to more of the private sector rather than state-owned companies, what do you see as the current relationship between those companies, between state-owned enterprises and the Chinese leadership?
Okay, so there's a lot going on right now in terms of the Chinese state and the state-owned enterprises. There is a, within China, of course, there is a significant push, you know, to rein them in to some extent, meaning much of the anti-corruption effort within China right now is targeting state-owned enterprises because they are a source of significant corruption, although in some cases people will see these as largely tied to enemies of the current president, Xi Jinping, so it's not quite clear exactly which companies are being targeted and why, but they're definitely a central focal point of the anti-corruption campaign. There's also an effort to take more of the profits from state-owned enterprise and bring them back into the central coffers. So, you know, up to 30% now of the profits of state-owned enterprises are supposed to go to Beijing. So there's, to some extent, I think, an overall effort within China now to rein them in. In terms of China's going out strategy and how the state-owned enterprises fit into that, it's interesting. One of the things we found was that the National Development and Reform Commission, which is really the sort of central brain trust in terms of the go-out strategy, will often set out a big sort of trade aid and investment scheme for a given country. So when you see President Xi Jinping or before him President Hu Jintao going off to Africa and going to several countries and announcing these very significant multi-billion-dollar trade aid investment deals, it's usually the NDRC that has sort of structured that and laid that out. But then what happens is the state-owned enterprises need to participate, and sometimes the state-owned enterprises don't want to participate. So one of the things here, too, is that the Chinese government is not quite the puppet master that we think that it is. And so sometimes it really cannot force these state-owned enterprises to take the kinds of stakes that they might want them to take. There recently was, for example, a piece in the Financial Times talking about how the NDRC wanted the Chinese steel companies to go out and continue to take large stakes in iron ore in Brazil and Australia and other places. And the Chinese steel companies, which are faced with enormous overcapacity, you may have been reading about this in the newspaper, said, no, we have no interest in further investment. You know, we've got iron ore piling up in the ports. But the Chinese government wants them out there doing that because They want to continue to have a voice in sort of the global trading regime and also for what they call sort of security issues, security reasons. They want these companies out there still investing. So I think that there's a reasonably significant gap at times between what Beijing would like for the state-owned enterprises to do and what the state-owned enterprises want to do in terms of actually going out and making money and being world-class competitors, you know, on par with the Western multinationals. So I think that that's one challenge in many respects that Beijing faces. Having said that, you can also find, you know, mining officials that say, when we go out to mine, we are doing it for the Chinese government. And so I think, you know, there's certainly an element of understanding that, you know, first priority for, you know, any of these large resource-based state-owned enterprises is to ensure that China's own resource needs are being met.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from the Monterey Institute for International Studies.
Go ahead. Hi, Dr. Economy. Thanks for your talk. My name is Gavin Anderson, and I have a question about a specific organization called the Xinjiang Production and Construction Corps, or the business name is the Xinjiang Group. I'm just curious if you are familiar with this organization, if you could say anything about its role in the westward expansion of international trade and the securement or extraction of resources in Xinjiang.
You know, I have not encountered this particular group, so I'm afraid I can't speak to it.
Okay. A more general question on the same lines would be, could you say anything about the relative importance of Xinjiang or Western China in terms of resources to, the importance of the extraction of resources from Western China to the continued development of urban China or Eastern China?
Sure. I mean, our book, you know, really focuses on China's investment in resources outside its own borders. But, you know, obviously, as I'm sure you know, the Go West strategy, which dates back to 1999-2000 under Jiang Zemin, the idea was that, the eastern part of the country would invest in the western part of the country, in part to elevate the standard of living in the West, right, but also to develop the West resources in order to supply the East. And most clearly in the case of Xinjiang, this deals with, oil and gas. I think what we've seen recently in terms of China's sort of pollution concerns is that they're talking about, further developing, coal in Western China, for example, in order to ensure that the eastern part of the country is not so polluted, right? And so having the coal mines and the coal-fired power plants be in the West and transmitting the power through transmission lines to the eastern part of the country. So there seems to be somewhat of a disregard for the pollution situation in the western part of the country to the benefit of the eastern part of the country. But I think that, generally speaking, the concern in the West has been that, the eastern part of the country will extract the resources, and the western part of the country does not benefit from this resource extraction, either financially or in terms of the jobs, with the vast majority of the higher-end engineering jobs and other things going to, Han Chinese who are brought in specifically to be part of this resource extraction. So I think that, Xinjiang certainly plays an important role. It's also a gateway to the rest of Central Asia. There are the ethnic issues involved in Xinjiang with the Uyghurs. So there's clearly security concerns that play into Beijing's thinking. But I think that, by and large, from the perspective of the West, whether we're talking about Qinghai or sometimes Gansu or Xinjiang or Tibet, I think there is a sense that there's a degree of exploitation of their resources, for the benefit of the eastern provinces.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Syracuse University.
Hello, Dr. Economy. Thank you for your thoughts today. We're calling you from the Maxwell School at Syracuse. There are many pressures on U.S. multinationals to apply advanced economy practices when operating in a developing world. I wonder if you could discuss the difficulties that are posed by the behavior of Chinese firms for American and European multinationals that compete with them while simultaneously trying to adhere to higher labor and environmental standards.
Right. I think it's an important issue. There is this sense that Chinese companies have an unfair advantage in competing against Western multinationals, in part because of the heavy involvement of the state in sort of low-cost access to low-cost financing and low-cost labor, namely Chinese labor coming across, but also because of sort of lower environmental and labor standards. It is a problem, but I will also note that states with stronger capacity want Western investment, and even states without stronger capacity want Western investment. And so, you know, a country like Mongolia, for example, you know, where, you know, 50% now of the investment of the overseas direct investment in Mongolia is from China, and 90% of Mongolia's exports go to China. But Mongolia is doing everything it can to try to attract investment from outside of China, from, you know, Western firms and elsewhere, and it's putting all sorts of restrictions that are pretty much designed to make it more difficult for Chinese companies. For example, saying, you know, if you want to bring a Chinese laborer in, you have to, for a mining investment, you have to hire 9 Mongolian workers as well, right? Or taxing the labor in Chinese, in any sort of construction effort or infrastructure project that's being financed from abroad that uses foreign labor. And so that, in one sense, gets at one of the advantages that China has when it goes to do its resource deals, its ability to underbid because it imports its own or exports its own labor to do this. Again, I think it's important to recognize, you know, countries like Brazil and Argentina have actually passed laws to limit the ability of countries to actually purchase land. And although they say this is not directed at China, most people know that China's role, China's rising interest in purchasing land played a pretty significant role in those decisions to pass those laws and new regulations. So I think when we're looking at states with relatively stronger capacity, they are indeed trying to, you know, push China to do a better job. It's harder in countries, it has been harder in countries like Zambia, for example. But here too, you know, you had a change in government, and all of a sudden the Chinese projects all came under greater scrutiny for their environmental practices, and some deals were lost. So there is unfair competition, but I don't think we should underestimate the ability of the resource-rich countries to sort of put in place regulations and strictures that will help to level the playing field.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from the Georgia Institute of Technology.
Hi, Liz. John Garver here. In the interactions between China and developing countries, you often find a lot of rhetoric in high-level communiques and so forth about the existing international economic order being set up by Western countries and unequal, and that a new international economic order needs to be set up more to the advantage of developing countries. In China's resource diplomacy, do you find much evidence or any evidence that China, in fact, desires or is seeking a new international economic order in terms of resources?
I guess, you know, that new international economic order, of course, you know, reminds me of the 1960s or the 1970s and where China sort of established itself as a leader of the developing world. I don't see as much evidence of that. I think perhaps the extent to which China, you know, has tried to put itself forward, you know, with its peaceful rise and the, you know, establishing itself as a different kind of power. It wasn't going to be a colonial power. It wasn't simply going to extract resources from countries in polluting and degrading ways. You may remember Zheng Bijian's sort of seminal piece in 2005-2006 in Foreign Affairs that spoke precisely to this issue. But I think, you know, in our interviews through and our research in the developing world, we did not find much evidence to suggest or to support the idea that China was viewed very differently. In fact, you can find many, many articles in the media, for example, in the developing world, talking about how China is just like a colonial power, how it is simply going in, extracting resources, and keeping the sort of value-added manufacturing for itself. And so one of the things that China has done to try to address this issue has been to develop these sort of special economic zones along the lines of the ones that it had itself, you know, back in the 1980s to try to promote manufacturing in some of these developing countries. I think there may be up to upwards of 30 of them now throughout the developing world. But for the most part, they have not really been terribly successful. And a lot of them seem to be just Chinese firms that are devoted sort of subsidiary efforts to Chinese investment. So a Chinese construction firm, for example, in a special economic zone that is helping with the infrastructure surrounding a mining investment, but not really anything that is employing local people and transferring technology and doing the kinds of things that the Chinese government has suggested. So while I think there may be a lot of high-level rhetoric talking about, you know, friendship and equality and the new international economic order, I don't see much evidence that this is being translated through into sort of China's resource quest.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College.
Are you there?
Hello, go ahead with your question. All right, our next question will come from the University of New Mexico.
Wow. Yeah. Thanks for being with us this morning, Dr. Economy. My question is related to what you spoke of on urbanization and unrealized investment. Much of China's resource consumption was driven by the housing market, which has resulted in numerous enterprises are encouraged to participate in the foreign direct investment market. Where might the focus of China shift?
So let me just try to understand your question is about the sort of real estate market in China and how the ghost cities will affect China's further resource quest, or what kind of opportunities there are for foreign direct investment in China. I didn't quite understand where you were going.
I'm curious if you had mentioned that state-sponsored multinational enterprises are continuing to participate in the foreign direct investment market abroad. Mm-hmm. Then where might their focus shift if they're not needing the resources that they previously needed that helped to drive their housing market?
I see what you're saying. Well, I think, you know, one of the issues will be on the energy front, for example. As I mentioned, there's not going to be, even with the urbanization process, there's probably not going to be any sort of diminution of demand for energy because, as I said, urban residents, you know, use four times more energy than rural residents do. Putting aside the housing issue, roads still need to be built, and, you know, railroads will be built, and, you know, other infrastructure related to the development of, you know, new industries for, you know, some of the new cities that will develop will also need to be, will also be pursued. So, you know, it's possible that, you know, you could see, for example, you know, not as much iron ore needed for steel, you know, that's used for, you know, houses. That's possible, I suppose, you know, but, you know, or perhaps, you know, timber, wood products, you know, logging issues that China faces with Indonesia and Mozambique might diminish, maybe. But I think this is probably 10 or 20 years out because I think there's going to continue to be demand for Chinese housing, even though in many areas you have these ghost cities. The problem is you have ghost cities where people don't really want to live. You don't have ghost cities in the 10 satellite cities that are surrounding Shanghai, for example. So the question really is whether you can get the people to move into these areas where they don't really want to live. Can you develop an urbanization strategy that's not completely dependent on sort of the major coastal cities? Because I think there's still a lot of interest in, you know, continuing to develop, you know, sort of outward from that part of the country.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Sure, better not.
Our next question comes from Aurora Barone with Affairs.
Hello?
Yes, this is New York University, the Center for Global Affairs.
Please.
I wonder, Dr. Connolly, if you could provide some insight regarding the current state of the negotiations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and more importantly, do you think it's in America's best interest to exclude the world's second largest economy from what could be the largest free trade agreement ever negotiated?
So I don't have much real insight to what's going on in the negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership because, as I'm sure you're aware, the negotiations are, for the most part, held relatively close to the vest. So what I know is pretty much what's been reported in the media. I think the greatest concern, frankly, right now is not whether China's not going to be part of it, but whether we're going to be part of it, since Congress has not given the President Trade Promotion Authority, and there seems to be a lot of unhappiness about the TPP within Congress. So I think we're going to have to wait to see whether the White House and Congress can move this forward, you know, on our own home front. And I think if we can't, this is going to be a significant hit to our credibility in the region because this is one of our centerpiece sort of efforts in our overall rebalance to Asia, you know, along with the security front and some other things on the political front. You know, whether or not China's not being excluded from the TPP, China is more than welcome to participate in the negotiations at the level that these other countries are participating, which is to say at higher with higher environmental and labor and intellectual property rights protection standards. So there is no exclusion of China, and within China, in fact, there is growing interest in participating in TPP. You know, from first viewing the TPP as an effort to contain China, the dynamic, the sort of discussion within China has shifted so that people, economic reformers within China view the TPP very much as economic reformers view the WTO, you know, basically back in the late 1990s under Zhu Rongji, which is to say as a mechanism for helping force further domestic reform. So I don't think there's an effort to exclude China. I think there's an effort to ensure that there's a high-end trade agreement and that when China is ready and able to participate, that it will do so, you know, at that same level of high-end labor, environment, and IP protection standards, among other things.
Great. Next question.
Thank you. Again, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key, followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone.
Liz, in your research for this book, what did you find to be the most surprising thing about China and its use of natural resources?
I think there were a number of surprises, actually. I think, you know, one was that this resource quest is not really unprecedented in history. You know, we tend to think of China's rise and sort of China's quest for resources as just the first time that we've ever heard of such a thing. But in fact, as our introductory chapter laid out, China is very much following in the path of other rising powers. This is a very normal sort of part of a rising power's trajectory, seeking resources from outside its borders. Also surprising to me, in our second chapter, we look at China's own history with regard to resources. And what's quite fascinating is that China, the way that China does business today, in some respects, is quite similar to the way that it did it, you know, in the Ming and the Qing dynasties, which is, you know, you had a strong central control, or at least strong effort at central control over the resource quest. You know, Peking determined who could participate in the resource trade, how much they could profit from the resource trade, where they could trade. All of these things were sort of determined. They tried to tell, you know, farmers within China what they should be growing. For example, you need to grow grain and not tobacco, even though tobacco makes more money. You know, grain, sort of the idea of grain security and resource security, which we continue to see today, was so very deeply embedded in China's own history. I think that was also surprising to us. So this sense that not as much of this is truly new, either within sort of the global context or within China's own history, as you might have thought. And I think the other really surprising thing was what I mentioned earlier about the fact that China is, in some respects, a second-tier investor. I think from reading the papers, you know, even I anticipated that, you know, China was going to be the largest investor in Africa and Southeast Asia and Latin America. And to find out that it was the third or fourth largest investor, and that, in fact, its investment is just dwarfed by its trade, and that in some key commodities, this commodity does not go back to China. It goes on the global market. I think this was also pretty surprising to me. So actually doing the research for this book was full of surprises, because there's been so much written that has been kind of so hyped up based just on, you know, one anecdote here, one anecdote there. Really digging down and finding out what was going on was really quite enlightening.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from San Diego State University.
Hello. Good morning or afternoon or wherever you are. My question is, recently China expressed or signaled disdain over President Obama meeting with the Dalai Lama, who they basically see as a terrorist. Because of China's growing complex interdependency with the West, do you see them improving their humanitarian outlook, especially as they reach for resources in areas like Tibet, and you mentioned their other geopolitical interests in Africa and the Sudan, but I'm particularly interested in the Congo, where it's arguable that China's ongoing efforts there are fueling the longest going civil war and deadliest conflict since World War II.
Yeah. So I would say that the push for China to elevate human rights concerns, both within its own country and in terms of, you know, where and how it thinks about doing business abroad, is still relatively nascent. And I think it's going to change, in part because of what I suggested, you know, the thought that the Chinese people themselves are now doing business in these, you know, sort of war-torn, you know, very, you know, violence-ridden countries, and that they are at risk, and that somehow the Chinese government is placing their sort of economic interests ahead of the interests of the Chinese people. I think that is something that, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years may begin to affect the way that the Chinese do business. But it's hard to say that the Chinese government has thus far placed, you know, humanitarian or human rights concerns ahead of their business interests in any sort of consistent manner. But I do think that pressures are growing from within China for them to sort of rethink this type of strategy.
I think we have time for one last question. My apologies to all of those who are still on the line, but we are at the end of our time. So one more question, Tiffany.
Thank you. Our last question will come from the University of Texas.
Yes, this is Josh Busby here. I'm curious about, with recent media reports about deteriorating Chinese air quality, I'm interested in how you think that will influence the Chinese government's efforts both to rebalance its economy domestically and what impact this might have both at home and if it's going to lead to more stringent environmental concerns for international investments or push them to try to move their environmental impact abroad.
You know, I think the situation with China's air quality right now, not to mention, of course, what we can't see, which is easily or which is not being talked about as much, which is its, you know, soil and soil contamination and water issues. Very clearly, these are already having an impact in terms of China's resource quest. So I think you can look and see, for example, that you know, China's outward search for land is going to be ratcheting up because it realizes that its, you know, own land has become so degraded and polluted that it needs to go out in order to, you know, access food. So, in fact, they're coming to the United States now. That's, you know, recently been in the Chinese media. And in part also just to access, you know, our technology. You know, Chinese Academy of Agricultural Sciences came out and said Chinese agricultural technology is 108 years behind that of the United States, which is really extraordinary. So I think that sort of what's taking place domestically in the environment in China is already having an impact on its resource quest. Whether they're going to try to outsource more of their polluting, heavily polluting industries abroad, you know, it's possible. So far what they seem to be doing is outsourcing them, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, outsourcing them to the western part of the country. you know, it may be that if they are able to rebalance their economy, move up services, you know, more of the manufacturing that they want to do, they'll do abroad. But so far, they still have, you know, several hundred million people that they need to employ that are not skilled labor, that are still best suited for sort of manufacturing and other industries. And so I anticipate that they will continue to face pretty serious environmental problems on the home front, even as they talk about improving, you know, environmental implementation, enforcement of their regulations. I have yet to see that happen.
Well, thank you, Liz, very much for today's call. We really appreciate your taking the time to do this.
Well, thanks for all the great questions. It was really terrific.
And thanks to all of you. I commend to you, if you've after this hour, commend to you Liz Economy's book that she co-authored with Michael Levy, By All Means Necessary, How China's Resource Quest is Changing the World. This is just a snippet of a great book to put on your reading list. I also encourage you to check in and sign up for the CFR blog post, Asia Unbound, that features Liz Economy and other fellows who are in our Asia Studies department. And to follow Liz on Twitter, at Liz Economy, for her insights in 40 characters or less. so I hope that you'll do that. Our next call will be on Wednesday, March 12th, with Steve Sestanovich, our CFR fellow on Russian and Eurasian studies, talking about ways in which we can strengthen American foreign policy. In the meantime, you can also follow our academic initiative on Twitter at @CFR_academic for information on new CFR materials, resources, and upcoming events. So thank you all again today, and we look forward to your continued participation.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online. CFR.org.